Yeah, I think we can.
Ooh.
Resume the hearing, thank you. On our day four, Ms. Scott, preliminary issues. Anything that occurred to me overnight that you might care to ponder for your reply? On Monday, we discussed whether or not the O&L lines should remain on the areas that have been withdrawn. Yesterday, I discussed with Mr. Barr the inverse of that position, whether they should be taken off, was it in fact before us. Another variation, Ms. Melsop has recommended acceptance of the Beresford submission that the location of the O&L on the Beresford land be shifted up the hill. That, of course, produces a mismatch on the western side with where Beresford land adjoins Peninsula Bay. You might care to ponder what we do about that mismatch, given that if the O&L shifted on the Beresford land, it will not join the O&L across the Peninsula Bay land. And since I talked to you on Monday, I have read the Chair's minute on the Queenstown issues, where a related point arises in relation to airport noise lines across the Remarkable Park Zone, where he has directed that the Queenstown mapping panel has no jurisdiction to consider those lines. Now, I'm not sure where that leaves us, but I'm sure you're going to tell me in reply.
That's on my mind, sir.
Thank you very much.
I just, before we turn to Mr. Barr, I do have one document to hand out. It is the copy of the covenants that he requested for Lindley Bay. So they've simply been extracted from the third Parkins Bay decision, which is the Upper Clutha Tracts Trust in Queenstown Lakes District Council. It's included in tab 14 of the Council's case book.
We're now up to Exhibit 5.
Yes, thank you.
While we're looking for additional paper to add to our collection, Commissioner McLeod has another request.
Was to do with the designation. It's over the Ballantyne Lords, the old the council currently hold it. It's used to be the old septic tank. Well, not septic tank for town, the two ponds, for want of a better description on the site. It's only if it would be possible to get that designation. It's it was acquired under compulsory civil works, compulsory purchase act, from the brother of one of the submitters, but yeah, just that designation.
Okay, is it the recommended, so that would have gone to the designations hearing, so I will look to see what happened during the course of that hearing and provide it to you.
That'd be great, thanks very much.
Looks like designation 51.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. There you go. Okay. This is 5, isn't it?
5. Any more
all preliminary issues?
That is all for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Proceeding, I think we're at part D of your evidence, Mr. Barr. So, perhaps if we might go through this a little slower and do it section by section rather than the whole of the part, because these are quite discrete issues. Any questions, team, on the overview and the discussion of the Wanaka urban growth boundary? Commissioner Hudson?
No, thank you, sir.
Commissioner McLeod?
There was one to do with the outer urban growth boundary that you discussed, and not included in the current statutory planning maps, and what was the rationale for that, the reason behind that? Obviously the modelling says we're fine for the
that's actually in the first part of part B from part 17.
Not in the wrong
part 17, but I'm happy to answer that, and I did touch on that yesterday. Essentially, if there was an outer urban growth boundary on the district plan maps, it would need to have a corresponding policy framework, potentially a rule framework that would provide a clear direction as to the use of that land, whether it be obviously not necessarily the immediate use, but the future use. And given the council's the outputs of the dwelling capacity model, we're comfortable with the capacity within the proposed urban growth boundary.
I'm just so interested in that process. This is something that will obviously be worked on between now and, dare I say it, assuming we're both sitting around these tables in 10 years' time, the next iteration of the proposed district plan. So that's the sort of scale of time frame that we're talking about for an outer growth boundary.
Potentially, yes. I mean, the council could undertake further sort of non-strategy further strategic planning exercises, produce non-statutory documents, and it's going to be obliged to do that through the requirements of the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity in any case. So I can, without committing the council to undertaking those projects, I can foreshadow that those sorts of exercises will happen.
And just dropping out of that from me personally would be another similar process to the Wanaka 2020 or the Hawea, those community plans we talked about yesterday.
I think so. Yes.
Thank you.
Commissioner Monroe.
Thank you, sir. Just following on from that, so I thought your commentary made a bit of sense when you were describing the likely effect of having an inner and an outer growth boundary is that the outer growth boundary becomes the de facto boundary. And the inner growth boundary effectively ceases to have much practical relevance. But reflecting on the conversations that have been, and the questions that have been put to you over the last several days, and it's been said a number of times that we've talked about things like the NPS and future capacity and where the capacity might be, and I wonder whether the prospect of an outer growth boundary, and I take your point about needing a policy framework, but in terms of what it would actually do as an instrument, like why would one have one? And I wonder whether that could be a vehicle through which concepts like deferred zoning or signalling where the next 10 years might be for the purpose of the next plan review not finding itself in the position we're finding ourselves in, where the council says we haven't thought about servicing that land, so the answer's no, and submitters, of course, haven't thought about it. And I wonder whether that might be the genesis of a method through which the next cycle of LTP projects that might give the council and landowners more lead-in to start thinking about where those logical extensions might be. Because I think that is certainly in my mind, between where the council is currently at with its current LTP and what might happen in the future, is a question to me. So I just was interested in your thoughts on that, including the extent to which an outer growth boundary could be a non-statutory, non-regulatory method, i.e. a form of working guideline of where the next logical, on the assumption that growth keeps happening. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't disagree in principle. I think the best benefit an outer growth boundary could have, whether it be statutory or non-statutory, would be to prevent rural lifestyle type development, rural living type development, which would make the further intensification of that land impractical or a business opportunity. At least the council could hypothetically have agreement from landowners saying, well, not just yet, but if you hang on for 15 years, you're going to go from rural to potentially urban, and there'll be a better yield for you, and everything will be a lot more efficient, and you won't be, you know, sort of batting the council, so to speak, to get what you want in the interim. That would be nice, but it does come back to, if that was going to be inserted in the district plan and become a sort of statutory line, then there'd need to be a very clear policy framework saying why.
Yeah.
Non-statutory, the same thing. I think you could potentially have people sort of jumping the gun, and the comment I made yesterday about if you essentially loosened the urban growth boundary, you could end up with ad hoc development, but it's just happening within a boundary, and then it's perceived to be okay.
Yeah, okay, thank you for that. I've got nothing else on that.
I have nothing else on that topic, so we'll move to section 18 and Hawea. My introductory question is actually more a comment. You'll recall, Mr. Barr, that the question of whether there should be a Hawea urban growth boundary was the subject of submission and hearing 14 months ago. The submission being that of Hawea Community Association. And so my comment, for the benefit of my colleagues, is that I think the question of principle as to whether there is a boundary is going to be determined, well, at least subject to recommendation, by the Stream 1B hearing panel, on which obviously I won. My question for you, therefore, is if that panel recommends a Hawea urban growth boundary, where should it be? Because that clearly is firmly within the jurisdiction of this stream.
I think to be consistent with my recommendations with respect to the rezoning submissions for the fringe of Wanaka, I think that proposed by the Hawea Community Association, which is in Figure 2, page 58 of my overview report, would be ideal. I'd be uncomfortable with a rural residential zone on the edge of the urban growth boundary because the densities on either side are the same. So you would lose the distinction of that boundary. Noting there that notwithstanding my recommendation on the submissions for the Mr. Rogers' evidence regarding the rural residential zone land off Lois Lane, is it, I think, in Grandview, the Grandview subdivisions. But I think that figure 2 seems sensible. concern I have, of course, is, and I might have mentioned this in my overview recommendations, is what happens to Lugget and just the consistency around urban growth boundaries around those settlements in general.
Just following up on that, what's the, like, I know the stats in New Zealand doesn't help by amalgamating the two, but do you have any, can you assist us and tell us what is the resident population of what we would term like Hawea Township and Lugget?
Not off the top of my head, sorry, but I can certainly come back to you.
Can you do that, please? So, again, on a hypothetical, if the Stream 1B panel recommended a Hawea UGB, we don't have, well, as far as I'm aware, there is no submission seeking a Lugget UGB. But would your recommendation be that that would be a logical next step?
Yes.
And from that, you're then looking at extending to, you know, the likes of everyone else, Makarura, Kingston, Glenorchy.
Maybe, which comes back to my...
Are we a flat?
Are we a flat's rural living zones? I don't think they're not urban. But Makarura, the township zones at Makarura would have to be considered in... Well, they would have to be considered. There's no submissions to the urban growth boundary around them. It would potentially depend on the either sort of perceived or anecdotal level of development pressure that you could expect, and how they relate to the urban development chapter overall, actually, as well. So.
And it is, I totally agree, it's a relatively long rural at Makarura, but Cadorna would be well there.
Potentially as well. And obviously it would involve altering the policy framework to Chapter 4 of the PDP, which is one of the reasons I think I discussed in the submission of the Hawea Community Association that formed my recommendation in this instance.
It does also reflect on one of the questions I asked the other day about the impact on productive soils. Because that whole flat at Cadorna, it's something that isn't. And as you go through the process, like for example, one of the things we've been discussing in terms of impacts is fire as an impact on a, and that was at Mount Iron, and that's a relatively new consideration for productive soils. I think we'll keep mentioning.
Point noted from the Commissioner. Commissioner Munro.
Thanks, sir. Just following on from that line of conversation about if there's a UGB for Hawea, what about all the other townships? Is that a matter of planning principle more than it's a matter of actual environmental best fit?
Arguably, as just a better resource management reason for an urban growth boundary at perhaps Hawea and perhaps Lugget, more so than Makarura.
I mean, in this instance, as the Chair said, it seems that there's an explicit submission calling for Hawea, but if for no other reason it gives us a pathway to consider it differently from the others. But for the purpose of us reaching a recommendation that might include advice for the Council, I'm still not seeing the point that says if there's a UGB on one, there needs to be one on all the others. Other than, as I mentioned, the matter of planning principle, which might still be legitimate. But it seems to me every one of the townships are different. They've got different growth pressures, they've got different contexts.
Yes. So my consideration will come back to what makes the Lake Hawea settlement so special.
Mm.
Just not, you know, over and above the fact that somebody decided to make the submission.
Mm.
I think it's a good idea. So I, you know, the policy framework in Chapter 4 includes settlements, areas without urban growth boundaries, and I'm pretty comfortable with that.
Turning to the recommended or potentially possible UGB, it's not recommended by you anyway, around Hawea, and you referred to the HCA's map, which I think came from the Hawea plan, 2020 plan. When we were talking to Ms. Melsop, not explicitly in the context of UGBs, but she expressed pretty clearly the view that development shouldn't cross Cemetery Road. And so I want to ask you about the desirability or suitability of that triangular-ish quadrilateral on the bottom there, and whether, in light of all the evidence we've heard, you would still include that or not.
I think there's more risk or concern from a perspective of retaining the integrity of the urban growth boundary and rural character on the southern side of Cemetery Road, that if you severed that triangular rural residential parcel off, it could create an argument for a unique circumstance that a resource consent for a similar density would be appropriate because it's right next door to it. So I think that it would be more robust and more of a comprehensive approach from the council's perspective to include that land, even though it does go across Cemetery Road. I think that the focus is really on the area zone rural and how that is grading into quite a sort of working rural landscape as you head along Cemetery Road towards Hawea Plain.
So one interpretation of the outcomes likely of the zone pattern is that people only choose to develop to the basic standards of the zone. And the other interpretation is that the zone does nothing but set up a framework of consents for people to start with what the zone rules allow and then go for gold. And in light of the conversation we had yesterday about expanding the Wanaka UGB to include land, there's the other argument that it, by including that land on the southern side, notwithstanding its zone, an applicant says, I'm in the UGB, why can't I have the urban density that's right on the other side of the road? What's the problem? The land is clearly contemplated to be within the urban growth boundary.
Mm.
And if that goes, does that not then completely undermine the prospect of keeping urban development off the rest of Cemetery Road once people go into it, they're already maybe seeing urban on both sides? Is that a risk too?
No, because I think the urban development chapter in the PDP would make that very difficult through a resource consent. And if that land that's zoned rural residential ended up within being contained within an urban growth boundary, I don't think it should be zoned rural residential anymore. And I think it should be zoned at least the hand we got dealt, which was large lot residential, or you look at it, you look at servicing, and you wonder if there's, well, you don't wonder, you investigate whether there's a better outcome in terms of the higher urban densities or something that will promote a better subdivision pattern and environmental outcome than what you can see in the Grandview subdivision, which is the rural residential land on the northern side of Century Road.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Mr. Barr. Nothing else, thanks, sir.
Thank you. Well, now we have the O&L section 19 of Mr. Barr's evidence. Mr. Hudson, would you like to kick off?
I haven't made any notes on any matters in this statement of Mr. Barr's that I wanted clarified. Or
okay.
So, no, I don't have anything at this
time. Motion to McLeod, section 19.
Yep. Look, I've got nothing further to add, but I'll just reiterate the discussion yesterday about a big question mark in my mind about those areas of undeveloped urban zone on land that might have otherwise been identified as a new colour of any. But I've got nothing further to add to.
Thank you. likewise.
Related to that matter, well, it's not my place to ask the panel questions, but one thing I'll be thinking about when we discuss the Beresford submission in relation to the what was put to me in terms of essentially if it's a Section 6 landscape, the plan should show that, and if the zoning doesn't fit, then make the zoning fit. The Beresford submission, the planning recommendation is to alter the UGB, to alter the O&L line over and above what's recommended by the landscape expert. So I'll be thinking about that if I get asked about the Beresford submission. And the other matter, which relates more to the planning frameworks and zones and the location of zones, is where we have a rural lifestyle zone within an O&L, that you need to be sufficiently certain that the policy framework and rules manage the effects of activities within that O&L. And I accept that the notified plan includes rural lifestyle zones within an O&L. However, I think it's important for me to consider, at least when we're thinking about the rezoning submissions.
Going on to section 20, which coincidentally, landscape boundaries and classifications on land other than rural, I have an initial point that relation to paragraph 20.4, where you quote the close exhibition to the resort zones, and I was stretching, I should have reread them, but I put my margin whether that was consistent with the closing position in the chapter 6 hearing, which, as we've just said, is 14 months ago, so it is a bit of a reach. Can you assist me?
I should be able to. Not off my head in terms of the reply or the closing legal submission position, or in particular my reply.
Fair enough.
It sounds as though you want me to take a look at it so I can do that and come back in the reply. Or?
Well, can we do it on an exceptions basis? Can you revert if having reviewed the chapter 6 reply, they are indeed materially at variance. I'm not concerned about expression or
Thanks. Okay.
It's in a substance position. The other point is that my recollection of chapter 6 is that, as notified, it said that O&L lines, in fact classifications, were only on rural zone land, and in chapter 6 you recommended that be shifted to the assessment criteria. Now, that provoked a certain degree of consternation from various parties about what the law that recommended change. Now, on on the assumption that Stream 1 panel accepts your recommendation and it's the assessment criteria that don't apply outside the rural zone, and this in fact comes directly to the point that you were saying you wanted to put on the table. In your view, do the rural lifestyle, do the assessment criteria that would apply to a rural lifestyle subdivision minus any O&L related assessment criteria, are they adequate to protect the O&L qualities? In this case, it would be small O, small N, small L, as Dr. Reed put it. And if they aren't, is that a problem? And again, and if it's a problem, whose problem is it? Is it our problem in particular? So that's a series of questions. If you just mull those over and address them in any order you like.
Answer to the first question is, sometimes. It depends on the context.
That sounds remarkably like a lawyer's answer, I understand.
I've acknowledged in the strategic overview evidence that it is a case of dealing with the hand we've been dealt. It's the case of deciding to not substantially reduce any development rights as far as notifying the plan. There are rural lifestyle zones that under the operative framework and including the proposed framework would be marginal at best in terms of giving effect to the Act in terms of Section 6B. The rural lifestyle zones in the notified plan, there were none in the Upper Clutha as we discussed yesterday, but the Wauna rural lifestyle zone.
No new ones.
No new ones, yes.
Because there is one at Makarora.
Wauna, which is in Glenorchy.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the new.
That one.
Is that, which is new. And to be fair, that does have fairly stringent measures in it, which satisfy Section 6B matters. The developable area is very small. There's some reasonably tight constraints on it. The other new rural lifestyle areas were in the Wakatipu Basin, and they largely reflected the existing environment, and also areas where there was capacity for that sort of the development envisioned under the rural lifestyle zone.
Can you just clarify, I was writing a note, you said your description was marginal at best in terms of Section 6. What were you describing?
The environmental outcomes of the zone, essentially, in terms of giving effect to the Act in Section 6B.
Is that a euphemism to say that's a problem?
Potentially problematic. And it's a point I've tried to emphasise in my rebuttal evidence and my Group 3 evidence, and that the level of intervention, while bothersome to applicants, future landowners, and also the council in terms of monitoring resource consents, can be a bit niggly, but that's what's required to make sure that the O&L and sensitive Section 7 landscapes are managed appropriately.
The presumably, given that the other alternative is that the Stream 1 panel recommends that the notified position remain and the landscape lines don't apply at all outside the rural zone, that would be even more problematic because none of the policies would apply. None of the ONL objectives and policies would apply.
Yes, they would. I think the notified text said that the landscape objectives and policies apply where landscape is at issue. So essentially that note wasn't as it's quite innocently drafted to try to use more for clarification purposes to emulate the operative district plan, and that the assessment matters, because under the operative district plan the three-step process for identifying the landscape and the assessment matters are in the rural zone. You don't do that even for non-compliant activities in the rural lifestyle or rural residential zone. You don't do that. You're not required to do that in any special zone, assuming that it's through the Schedule 1 process, through the plan change, I'm guessing there was a fairly rigorous landscape assessment undertaken. So that drafting note was essentially just not to confuse people that they needed to go through the assessment matters for activities within the rural lifestyle zone and rural residential zone.
I think what you're telling me is that the drafting note was poorly drafted.
I see that.
It provoked confusion rather than the clarity that you were seeking.
So I'm reasonably comfortable with where it is now with respect to the rural zone, and clearly once you change it to assessment matters because they're embedded in Chapter 21 themselves, you don't need to say that they don't apply to Gibson. It's got its own, and as we discussed, the rural lifestyle and rural residential zone have their own frameworks, and there's not an expectation to go there in terms of the assessment matters in Part 21.7.
And that on a hypothetical, if the Stream 1 recommendation were to run with a literal interpretation of the note, am I correct that that would be even more problematic in terms of the outcome as to whether, for instance, an RL zone in an ONL with small initial caps, no initial caps, that would be a problem in relation to Section 6?
Yes, it seems to work.
Now, in terms of your 2016, with regard to the ONF boundary affecting LDR zone land, I think that's on Mount Iron. You said, well, the rules of the LDR zone allow development is permitted activity, and that's residential development, obviously. That would suggest, well, the question is the jurisdiction to alter it? Has anyone sought to shift that?
Not the zoning, no. And it's the same issue presented by what we discussed yesterday with the issue arising from this Milsos appearance with some land near Old Station Avenue, Wanaka, around the fringes of Lake Wanaka. And then I think the scope of the submissions restricted to identification of ONL and not the zone itself.
And so that comes back to Commissioner Monroe's point that he's been hammering away on, that if it's an ONL, it should be the zoning that goes, not the ONL. Or an ONF. So there's no jurisdiction to dezone it either.
No.
Can I ask a related question to the Scott to think about? Specifically in terms of getting close to actual legal advice on this is an example of a point that a number of submissions raise, and that is that if a submission raises, for instance, identify the ONLs, and a more generic or bland outcome like that being sought, do we have the scope to require any consequential changes to the plan required to provide that outcome, such as if an ONL to grant the release sought goes through an area of proposed zoning that would be offensive to the ONL being implementable or administrable, does that generic submission grant us the opportunity to take steps to fully give that relief without them having to specify exactly on site X, please remove the area of Y zoning?
Yes, I'm not going to answer that question in full, but we'll note that the chair of the wider review panel has sought advice on that matter specifically,
okay.
and I'm sure it can be made available to you.
I think the answer was yes.
The answer was yes.
Hmm.
There is some discussion before you get to yes, but
I'm sure it was worth every penny.
It's very short, and it's not keen by us, but
yes. This guy is being very tactful because it wasn't a Simpson recently.
Really?
No, it's very short and concise, but the advice has been given to the panel, which will assist you, and
okay.
The short answer is yes.
Right. I think all we need for Commissioner Monroe's benefit is the link, because it's on the website somewhere,
mm-hmm.
And I dare say I might even be able to find it, but it's probably better if you could please, Ms. Scott, provide through the admin team a link.
Yes.
I think you need to provide since Commissioner Monroe is travelling light, he probably just needs the website link.
And, sir, just on that point, if you'll indulge me, just so we don't have to raise the conversation up in about half an hour's time when we get to the actual example I had in mind. Later on, it was in the context of the Wanaka Kiwi Holiday Park submission and the other submission seeking a visitor accommodation overlay. And so the extension of this discussion, but with the same point, is if submitters have asked for the overlay and we were to agree with it, does that extension of scope include us crafting whatever other objectives, policies and methods required in the likelihood that the zones themselves don't already happen to have policies talking about VA, there would need to be some other framework in the plan that we could actually grant the relief in the absence of the submitter actually saying, by adding objective one, have an overlay, policy one, use the overlay, etc., etc.
I'll just comment at this point in time that will also require a section 32AA to be completed by the panel.
Oh, yeah, no, I understand all that.
Yes.
This is just a matter of how far can we go to address these kind of submissions, because one option is the technicality of, well, the submitter didn't give us all of the provisions they would need to actually give them the relief they seek, so no. The other relief is we agree with what they want, and on the basis of what we've heard, section 32AA, etc., this is a way of doing it. And the third option is we agree but we don't know how to do it, so council please consider further.
Yes, well, my answer at the moment is probably to be provided on a case-by-case basis. I can't give a blanket. That might be okay. But we can look at that particular one.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
My recollection of that opinion was that it was framed, it was one step further back, Ms. Scott, that the question posed and answered in the affirmative was, if someone sought a rule change, did that give jurisdiction to amend the objectives and policies? So that's
quite different.
Well, but it's further in the sense of, if there were, here I say, the Latin tag would be a fortiori. It's more problematic
in terms of moving from rules to a complete suite of provisions than someone saying, I want a zone, and a zone will necessarily have.
Yeah, well, that's really what the overlay amounts to.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. But Ms. Scott, you will assist with a on the particular example troubling Commissioner Monroe.
Mr. Chair, I think it's almost in the inbox.
Faster than the speeding bullet. So does the Pete.
Done.
Technology.
Yes, indeed. Now, can we go back? We're discussing landscape boundaries and classifications of the land other than rural, so section 20. I've asked my questions. Commissioner Moreau, do you have anything else?
No, thank you, sir.
Commissioner Hudson?
No, thank you.
Commissioner McLeod?
No, thank you.
All good. Now, MDR, section 21. Mr. Barr, you've been remarkably thorough, but I think you may have missed a submission and not discussed it. This is Mr. Cutler, who sought an extension of the MDR zone. It's on your schedule at page 5. Now, I'm not asking you to give me an instant answer, but can you take a note, tell that Mr. Cutler isn't appearing, provide evidence, but I think that we need a reasoned response. Happy to receive it and reply.
Thank you.
Now, I didn't have anything else on section 21 myself.
No, not that one.
Mr. Hudson?
No, thank you.
Pass. Well, glory be. We've finished the first brief. Oh, no, we have one left. The McLeods. Anything on the McLeods? That's a no. Finished the first brief. One down. Four to go. I thought that, McLeod, that we would now go to the DCM brief. Since that is a... in effect, an extension of your strategic analysis, because it underpins the more specific zone analysis. Now I'll get in first. Question I asked Mr. Osborne. He gave me an answer on the sensitivity of the model DCM calculations to the assumption that there would be a drop in the percentage, a drop in the absolute numbers of unoccupied dwellings. Can you assist us on the reasonableness or otherwise of that assumption, in your opinion, as among other things, there's a lot of wisdom.
The rationale behind the... So this is the reasoning. Just to be clear, you're asking essentially what the reasoning is why the amount of unoccupied housing is going to fall.
Yes.
So that's based on the rationale projections, and the reason for that is because the amount of essential holiday home housing stock is going to decline as people sell their old thatches or cribs or holiday homes, and they become redeveloped and occupied by permanent residents, whether they be homeowners or rentals. Similar to what I've been told is happening in Arrowtown with properties being redeveloped, and apparently with the old sort of batches being sold and being bought or redeveloped. On the face of it, it seems slightly extraordinary, but I accept Rationale's findings. I would have thought somewhere like Wanaka, the level of the houses purely for holiday purposes, or just people who have the ability to have more than one house and leave one empty at any particular time, and they want to do that in something like Wanaka, I thought there'd always be a steady state relative to the population, but apparently not. Apparently that will fall as Wanaka becomes perhaps more of a town, so to speak, rather than just a holiday resort.
Is it fair to say, is it, we'll believe it when you say it?
I'm not sure, I guess we will.
Like, it's in there. You said it will happen. These are, of course, all predictions.
That's right.
And it's how well polished your crystal ball is.
Correct. Good point, yes. So I've got no basis to doubt Rationale's projections. I understand they'll be coming from a reasoned, informed and reasoned source. So I'm happy to accept them.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your paragraph 2.3 and as I read this doesn't answer Ms. Hampson's argument that there is a latent demand for what she called attached homes, terrace housing apartments, because this is an overall position. Do you think there's scope to run that position? Not scope in the technical legal sense, but that there is an issue because the DCM is an overall dwelling assessment, that within the subgroups of different housing types, there could be shortages, and to your mind as a planner, is that an issue in terms of giving effect to the NPS?
I accept that, and I do recall Mr. Osborne's evidence yesterday where he also, correct me if I'm wrong, or I'll be correct if I'm wrong, said that there was always a potential for a small, or at least a small, latent undersupply associated with a certain type of housing. In the case of Wanaka in particular, that it could be the case, but it's limited. And as Mr. Osborne discussed, it depends on the market preference and it depends on the developer's will to construct terrace housing if they favour that as a safer investment than standalone housing. And to that point, when you look at the median density zones, that is one of the zones that encourage terrace type housing, and the DCM's outputs are quite conservative in terms of the realisable capacity from that. So I think Mr. Osborne said acknowledged that it's not always a popular model of investment is terrace housing with property developers or investors. Related specifically to Ms. Hampson's evidence in the Beresford submission, the zonings sort don't encourage terrace housing either. But we can come to that.
Yes, that's the question I was going to ask Ms. Stephen, because there does seem to be a disconnect between Ms. Hampson's analysis and what the submitter is seeking. I was going to broaden the question. Can you put your finger on any rezoning application among those that you've analysed, because of course Ms. Jones has a separate remit alongside you, but of all of the rezoning applications that you've reviewed, are any of them specifically targeting that latent demand, if it exists, for what you might call attached apartment dwelling to in effect provide affordable, low-cost housing in Wanaka or anywhere else in the Upper Clutha for that matter?
Only in the context of the submitted seeking medium density zoning. No one sought high density residential zoning. Wanaka only has one high density residential zone. So the short answer is only those who have sought the medium density zoning, but having said that, their case has been to provide a variety of housing stock, but they haven't specifically said we will construct terraced housing. This model is going to be more affordable, or not so much affordable, but this model of housing is going to fill a gap. Mr. Munro's submission relating to medium density zoning, I think in the Kurimoko low density land, might have said something to that effect, but I haven't seen anything qualified or guaranteed that that's what would actually happen if the zoning was successful.
Is it Munro or is it Murray? The current, the medium MDR next to Kurimoko, sorry.
I think it's Alistair Munro.
Is it right? Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Munro is the one who wants to uplift the DRA, isn't it?
As well.
As well?
Yes.
As MDR?
Yes.
And Wanaka Central sought MDR up there too, didn't they?
Yes. It could be Wanaka Central instead of Alistair Munro. Alistair Munro might be more interested just with the building restriction area being uplifted around the edge of the peak area.
And one further, if I may.
Absolutely, you got it.
I know this may be... happy to take legal opinion if this is outside of the brief, but I'm aware that through the SHA process a couple of people have looked at specifically that the medium density, the visitor worker accommodation entry level. Are you aware of any of that?
I'm not across the council's SHA portfolio or expressions of interest.
That's fine. Thanks.
Now, just checking my other notes. On the basis that no one's overtly seeking affordable homes and the developers don't seem to be interested in utilising the MDR facility, is that a future issue for, and no one's submissions, no one's made submissions that would enable us to address that issue, well not directly, is that a future area for giving effect to the NPS?
Well, I'd have to have a look at the NPS and see where it have all said or identified as a matter of affordability head on. It's more about the NPS, it's more about realising capacity and leaving the market and ensuring that there's sufficient, what's the phrase it uses, competition, rather than identifying the, or leveraging off the phrase of affordability itself.
This is for a true label, urban development capacity, isn't it?
Mm.
So possibly not. I wonder if you could please note that as a matter for reply. As I say, because there are no submissions, at most it's something that we would need to note as an issue for another day. But if on review of the NPS your collective conclusion from council, either the planning or legal response, is that the NPS doesn't directly require provision of what we might call affordable housing, then that would be a useful thing to know that that's not a loose end for compliance with the NPS. Whatever issues that council might have for other reasons. Now, that was all I had on the DCM brief. Commissioner Munro.
Yes, thanks. Just on the matter of the NPS. So, if we just connect back to the strategic overview report we've just gone through and those submissions that propose the medium density housing zone in Wanaka, would, in your view, Mr. Barr, one grounds for not supporting those submissions be the requirements of the NPS?
Yes. And in particular, in policy, I can't find it, sorry, for the sake of slowing things down, the policies that emphasise competition in the market and housing choice.
When we discussed the model specifically yesterday, Mr. Osborne, and it's been foreshadowed over the last few days, I've talked a few times about the residential flat, and he indicated that the additional capacity that they could provide possibly should be counted as dwellings for the purpose of the DCM. Is that a view you share, or do you have a different view?
Well, if you go both ways, I think residential flats are very important, and especially when you're looking at a work accommodation scenario, which at certain times, or it seems that all the time, that the town is short of. But at the same time, if we used residential flats, especially in terms of the plan enabled, adding them to our plan enabled capacity, I think the DCM could have been criticised for leaning on that when, as discussed by Mr. Osborne, that there's a likelihood that a residential flat might be used intermittently for permanent rental type accommodation. It might never be used at all, or it might just be used for guests. But having said that, there's anecdotally that residential flats that are lawfully established are a pretty good income stream for the visitor accommodation market as well. So I'd be interested to see if the council could run some analysis in terms of the building consents, because a residential flat would need a building consent. So we should be able to find that data out pretty easily. So at least not in terms of hypothetical plan enabled, because simply adding another household unit onto every plan enabled low density residential section could be drawing a bit of a long bow. At least looking at what's been consented might be quite helpful.
I'll take from that, correct me if I'm wrong, but agreement that it would seem that there's some additional capacity that hasn't yet been counted. Whatever significance that has remains to be seen.
Yep, that's right.
So what I want to do now is take a step back with you. The NPS has some pretty clear requirements, but in the absence of a planning regime that compels people to develop any particular outcome in any particular time frame, we're inherently speculating what might happen. And with no criticisms of technical experts at all, but if one throws more money, one can always make a model more sophisticated, more elaborate, more refined.
The chocolate fish award.
And as we start going into matters such as Ms. Hansen's evidence about swell, getting into subcategories, and what I want to test with you from a planning perspective is there a point where we're just splitting too many theoretical hairs and for the purpose of a plan change, is there a point where one can have reasonable certainty that the best efforts have been done to meet the requirements of the NPS? In the absence of rules that say, and this landowner must build X houses within the next 10 years or they go to jail. You see what I mean? There's a conclusion that we don't have the ability to compel any particular realisation of any particular yield. So, at what point are we just fooling ourselves?
I don't disagree. But in short, I think one of the best things the NPS does is ensure that councils don't sit back and say they've got sufficiently zoned land that might just be in a 45 degree slope with the landowner who's more interested in farming it, even though it might have been zoned low density residential for the last 20, 30 years. So it forces councils to have a hard look at zoned land, but at the end of the day, you're right. You can only model things so far, and it depends on the willingness of a landowner or a willingness of somebody to want to purchase that land and develop it.
And of course, a developer that tells the council at a plan making stage they want to develop might sell the land in 6 months for someone else who has a very different view anyway.
That's right. And I could talk to that in terms of some of the rural living rezonings as well.
Well, really, I think what I'm trying to do is gauge at what point we don't need to worry about whether Ms. Habson's right or wrong to the nth degree, or other people that might question should there be more capacity for affordable housing or unaffordable housing or premium retirement village housing or whatever the sub-market may be.
Yes, I agree. It's not so much a case of her being right or wrong or more right than Mr. Osborne. It's more a case of if Mr. Beresford, for example, guaranteed that he was going to do something within a certain period of time, that might be more beneficial. In some respects, that's reflected in our DCM outputs because our special zones or that we know are well underway, such as Northlake, we haven't applied the same realisable constraints or against it because those are master planned neighbourhoods with owned by development companies who are intent on developing them, and they are, so they haven't been and had the same factors applied to them.
I'll approach what I was asking in a slightly different way. The NPS requires the council to continuously monitor demand and supply. Correct? And the council has powers to initiate plan changes or variations whenever it seeks outside of just a set plan review time frame. Is that correct? So, does that create something of a, for want of a better term, insurance policy, such that even if we got it horribly wrong, it doesn't start or end with this particular plan change process? The council has a number of levers and opportunities, as the case may be, to create additional supply for different types of housing, as the case may be, as the circumstances depend, whenever it needs to.
Yes, I agree. With the council needing to look at the NPS annually and see where it's going, it would need to look and see why some zones aren't being developed and how they need to discount those zones more. Mr. Osborne talked about the speculative nature of land transactions in this district. So, notwithstanding that I accept that the Chapter 4 of the PDP would make it difficult for a resource consent outside of the urban growth boundary, there's nothing stopping the council from having a hard look at that. And
well, the NPS would require the council to have
right.
a hard look at it.
That's right. And contemplating it. And if a landowner came along and said, I want to do this, and I can guarantee that it will happen, then that's something the council might have to entertain.
And so, notwithstanding the view of the council's experts, that's the modelling work is robust and we can have confidence that all these matters are being met. Even if we were to identify a question to do with affordable housing or the proportion of attached housing or whatever the case may be, that wouldn't necessarily lead to a constraint on us supporting the plan as proposed. in light of the council's ongoing powers to monitor, adjust, correct, fix as the case may be.
No, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. I've got no other questions on this.
No, thank you.
Commissioner Pratt.
I'd like to look further on that line, but I'm not exactly sure of the question. I was going to point out that having rolled a tractor, the difficulties of farming on a 45 degree slope. But in terms of dealing with the NPS, are there, you know, mechanisms that council can use to compel or to encourage developers to develop? In terms of time limits or penalties?
I'm not sure in terms of an RMA.
Yeah.
That's sort of trump card of the SHA is that it's a consent and it can have a limited life. So that's the difference. That's essentially the sort of the difference between the first scheduled zoning and the SHAs, which is a different process that the council are dealing with right now. And that's probably why the council would be reluctant to provide zoning for any consented SHAs, because it might remove that incentive. So we don't have any in the plethora at the moment, though, so it's not really something I'll turn my mind to.
Just pushing on from the commissioner's question, has council considered a minimum density as well as a maximum density in any zones?
No, well, certainly not in the notified plan. We had conversations about that internally, but they clearly didn't make it to the notified plan. So the short answer is no.
And what's your personal view as a planner about that as a concept? If the issue with the MDR is that it's not actually being developed to capacity, is the way forward a greater level of intervention to force development closer to capacity, if not at capacity?
Well, it would ensure a design outcome. It would ensure a greater chance of the zone outcome that sort being achieved, and it would ensure efficient use of resources and infrastructure where those medium density zones, high density zones have been located. But overall, there's the merits of it. I'd have to reserve my view on that, sorry. I know that it was quite contentious for the recent plan processes.
Commissioner O'Brien.
No, that's a very lawyer's answer again. Beautiful. No, that's fine. Thanks very much. Perhaps for the next plan review.
So, I think we're now well briefed down.
Thank you.
Go to your 1A.
Could I have the rebuttal open at the same time?
So probably a good idea. That's fine, doesn't it? Hotel, it's withdrawn from the request to be heard of the hearing. Commissioner McGrath, you're probably first on most of these.
Okay. So we've already briefly touched on this submission. So my questions are more procedural around were we to support the relief. What would actually be required? to give effect to the relief, and can we do that? And specifically, and I think my question is equally to Ms. Scott as well as Mr. Barr.
Generically, that's a question for Ms. Scott to answer. For this submission in particular, I think you can, because I think the Section 32 that was attached to the notified submission, or at least the planning statement attached to it, identified an objective and a policy.
But where would that objective and policy sit?
It would sit in the large lot residential chapter. So my understanding is that they seek a visitor accommodation overlay, which is, you know, a subset of the zoning principle. So it would sit within the large lot residential zoning framework.
Okay. So on that matter,
notwithstanding this particular site, but now looking at the zone as a whole, where the objective would sit, do you think it's appropriate that for the zone as a whole, it should enjoy a visitor accommodation overlay type series of provisions? Because my understanding of the use of overlays rather than zones inherently was that it allowed effectively allowed the council to get around its opposition to spot zoning. Rather than generically opening up all the zones to these things. So this is one of those circles of logic of actually giving effect to the relief sort might actually create a whole bunch of other issues that dissuade us from going where we might have originally thought we'd go.
Yes, it does. So any relief sort would potentially need the creation of a, dare I say it, a district-wide type of
That's where one through the question ends up, and so where does that lead us?
Which is problematic because I'm not sure if the submitters are seeking visitor accommodation within the environment of outcomes anticipated for each zone in terms of the bulk location of buildings, setbacks, and an uncertainty I have with, I suppose, the legacy of the operative plan and its use of subzone overlays is that the intensity seems a bit of a mystery to me. You're not sure if you're going to end up with an oakridge or a campervan park.
And that's a question I've got about. Are the addition of those provisions to the LLRZ generally inherently in conflict with the balance of the zone provisions?
I think if you look at the yes in short, and if you looked at the legacy of the Oak Ridge Resort, that was zoned rural lifestyle. Is your answer.
So, look, that's fine. That's what I thought your evidence was effectively amounting to. So, Ms. Scott, following on from that, do you think, and I've read that legal opinion, thank you, that was flipped through it faster than a speeding bullet, in this instance, for example, would we be able to agree with the submitter, agree broadly with the content of the objective and provisions put forward, not agree that they are appropriate to sit within the zone as has been requested, but needed to effectively become effectively creating a VA subzone separate to any particular zone? Would that of itself create material and fundamental changes to the plan such that it stops becoming fairly and reasonably within scope and becomes something else?
Before Ms. Scott answers, can you just repeat that question?
Okay. I will not only repeat it, I'll try and make it more concise. If we were to agree with the submitter that visitor accommodation overlay was appropriate, and we were to then agree that the necessary provisions to administer the overlay broadly as proposed by the submitter in its own submission and evidence were suitable, i.e. objective, policy, control activity methods, etc., but we did not agree that it was appropriate to house those provisions within the generic zone as a whole, as has been sought, for all the reasons that Mr. Barr's outlined, and that instead those provisions would sit outside of any particular zone, i.e. would create a new VA subzone limited to anywhere on the planning maps it applied. Would that change, i.e. the creation of a de facto new subzone, push beyond what could be argued as being within the scope of the submission on the grounds that it was creating a de facto structural change to the plan? So basically I'm trying to test the edges of what point the submission is going too far in terms of what it's asking the plan to do.
On that note, I think we might adjourn. Morning tea.
I was ready for a yes no. I get the hint, I'll ask further questions for this video.
Short question. We'll return at 25 to 12.
I don't know what you mean. Short questions, what are you talking about?
You've got two live questions too.